Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, there's nothing like the power of music to change people's lives, literally. Back in the 1960s, for example, a young boy in Ireland heard a Woody Guthrie album and he was immediately hooked. Today, that little boy is arguably the finest interpreter of traditional Irish music, and thanks to the Fiddle and Bow Society, Andy Irvine is coming to Winston-Salem this weekend for an intimate concert you do not want to miss. Then, University of North Carolina School of the Arts School of Filmmaking Professor of Cinema Studies Dale Pollack takes us behind the scenes for a look at the ever-growing relationship between movie making and merchandising in the post-Lego movie world. Poet Becky Gould Gibson is the author of Heading Home, and she sits down with Bethany Chafin to cover, among other things, the essence of poetry and the life of an artist. Irish music, Lego moneymakers, plenty of poetry, and a hearty tip of the hat to the Moravians, next on Triad Arts Weekend, after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Fiddle and Bow Society has been bringing outstanding traditional and contemporary folk artists to the Triad for 33 years. That tradition continues this weekend when one of the most important members of the Irish music revival makes a rare appearance in Winston-Salem. Singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and founding member of many seminal bands, Andy Irvine will perform in the intimate confines of the Community Arts Cafe. The Irish Times describes Andy as often copied, never equaled, and the Sydney Morning News says his playing is never less than breathtaking. His new CD, Parakilna, was recorded in the Australian outback, and we're sampling from that album right now. But it was decades ago in Dublin that young Andy made a musical discovery that would change his life forever. His name was Woody Guthrie.
I was taken with the name Woody Guthrie, and you know, I thought Woody was a great name. I'd never come across it before. And one day I was walking past a small record company in London, and I saw this LP called More Songs by Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston, and I rushed in and I bought it, and I brought it home, and I put it on the turntable, and the very first sound I heard, I was hooked. I think it was, the song was Columbus Stockade.
Way down in Columbus Stockade, where my friend went back on me.
I don't know, I was just instantly hooked, and then I studied up on Woody after that, and I liked what everything he said. I liked his lifestyle, I liked his outlook on life, and he became a real hero of mine, a lifelong hero, in fact.
And I love the correspondence you all had and the fact that he made mention of you in a letter and thanking folks. It's a beautiful story.
Yes, well, you can imagine, I think I was 17 or 18 when I got that, and it was the Woody Guthrie newsletter, and it said Woody would like to thank, and there were all these names like Pete Seeger and Jack Elliott and Oscar Brand and a whole list of them. And then at the bottom it said, and to Andy from Woody personally. And I went very red in the face, and my heart nearly leapt out of my mouth when I saw that.
It's of three huntsmen brave and bold, as I have heard them say. They took 500 guineas, all on one market day. And as they rode home together, o'er the Wicklow mountains high, oh, it's hold your horse, cries Johnson, for I hear a woman cry.
The song and the story of this traditional tune, The Three Huntsmen, I was listening to that yesterday from your album, Abo Curra.
Curra, as if it was C-U-R-R-A. It's the name of the townland in which I live in County Fermanagh.
You tell that story so well and so just beautifully wrought. The last line at the end, it had me thinking, you know, when people first heard these tunes back when, I guess, the turn of the last century, what it must have been like.
It's a good little novella, that song, too, isn't it? It's a story with a bit of a twist and a good short story, all right.
And Johnson getting on his horse, the woman got on behind. They rode down that lonesome valley, their fortunes for to find. And as they rode on along the way, as fast as they could ride, she threw her fingers to her lips and she gave three shivering cries. Out sprang three bold and struggling men with swords keen in hand, who commanded him to tarry, commanded him to stand. I will stand, says Johnson. I'll stand then, says he, for I never was in all me life afraid of any three. And Johnson killing two of them, not minding the woman behind, as he was at the other one, she stabbed him from behind. The day was free and the market day, the people all passing by could have seen this awful murder, could have seen poor Johnson die.
What drew you to the bouzouki? In your hands, is it more lute-like in that sense? What does it give you that say a guitar does not?
Well, you know, in the days when I played the guitar, nobody knew about dadgad, which is a guitar tuning, which probably is as good, if not better, than the bouzouki. But the thing about the classical tuning of a guitar was that it had too many strings and there were too many thirds in the chords. Hmm. The chords were too full, you know. The great thing about the bouzouki is it's tuned mainly in fifths, apart from the top string is a fourth above the second string. And therefore, it's a lot more modal than a guitar in classical tuning.
Okay.
E-A-D-G-B-E. So it's, in a way, it's restricted. But it also means, because it's only got four courses of strings, if you want to play a chord which on a piano would probably have about six or even seven notes in it, you've only got the possibility of playing four of those notes on the bouzouki. So you have a much more subtle chordal approach on the bouzouki than you would on the piano or on a classically tuned guitar.
Hmm.
Its very limitations are to its advantage.
That's a great expression. I've used that many times. It might have been Stravinsky that said something like, the more restraints I have, the freer I become, or something along those lines.
Oh, really? Great. Well, me and Stravinsky go back a long way.
You and Igor. Great. Jumping from Igor to Australia, what was your camping experience like there for this most recent recording?
Well, it was bloody cold, if I can say that. You know, I mean, the people in Ireland, anyway, I don't know about here, they believe that Australia is kind of, the sun is always shining down and it's always hot. But in the winter, July was when we were there, and in the South Australian desert, it was very, very cold. And we were sleeping in swags, and a swag is a kind of really cut-down tent. So it's like a coffin, in fact, you know, a canvas coffin. And after about a week, I got so claustrophobic, I had to get out and put up a tent. But you have to go to bed at night wearing one's full outfit of clothes, with a sweater, coat, hat, gloves, even in a fairly good sleeping bag. And still you would be aware of the cold. But yeah, myself and Rens van der Zalm, my old friend from Holland, we had a laptop computer and we had Pro Tools in it and we had a sound module and we had a few good mics and we recorded in wool sheds and old abandoned schools and shearers' quarters and anywhere we could find a nice kind of acoustic. And the album came out, which is called Parachilma, which is the name of a very, very small town in South Australia that we were kind of based in.
I'll sing you a song of Billy Farr, a true story without a shadow of a doubt. He lived in Melbourne in Footscray, but he found himself up Sydney Way, found himself up Sydney Way.
Was the playlist pretty much set up before you got to Australia? Were you working that out on the road while you were there?
Well, we did a bit of both. Like, I played quite a bit with Rents, and so some of the stuff he would have known, and other stuff we rehearsed before recording it. And, of course, we really wanted to record it at night sitting around the campfire, but the campfire makes such a noise. And it doesn't sound like a campfire. I mean, if a campfire would only record sounding like a campfire, it would be a very good recording. It doesn't sound, just makes kind of cracks all the time. The sound of things breaking.
Wild and furious blew the blast, and the sky with anger frowned. When the Dandenong from Melbourne sailed to Newcastle, port was bound.
Well, the sound itself, I mean, I was really struck by it. I was thinking, how in the heck did they do this without being in a recording studio? Because just the isolation of the voice and everything.
It's extraordinary, and it wasn't easy, you know, because there was a lot of spill from one mic to the other. And we did spend a lot of time in the studio afterwards editing it and mixing it. Because, as you say, it had come out sounding really good quality.
Well, I love how the tune Outlaw Frank Gardner begins. Where was that one recorded? It starts off with you two laughing over something in the background.
I think, as far as I recall, we had to try to record it about four times and screwed it up each time. And so I said, right, okay, this is it. One, two, three. And lo and behold, it was.
This is it, then.
Okay. One, two.
Frank Gardner, he is caught at last. He lies in Sydney jail for wounding Sergeant Middleton and robbing the Mudgee Mail, for plundering of the gold escort, the car.
Well, Renz is such an amazing musician too, and you guys go way back. What does that give you? What does a lasting friendship like that give you in terms of your music making together on a project like this?
Well, Renz is not only a really good musician on mandolin, guitar, fiddle, and other instruments, which he doesn't play with me, but he plays the accordion, plays the tin whistle, plays the Ilan pipes, although not usually when people are listening. but not only is he a great musician, but he will come to rehearsal knowing more or less how the thing goes and what he's going to play. So, you know, there's nothing as boring, really, as rehearsing something which you know backwards and teaching it to the other people. Like, the number of people, for instance, I have taught The Plains of Kildare, you know, with it, where it goes from 6-8 into 7-8, you know, I mean, the number of people I've rehearsed that with are legion, and it would drive you mad, you know, because it's difficult, and they would take rather longer than my attention could stand. But Renz would come to rehearsal, having worked that out, you know, as an example, he'd be able to play that immediately because he doesn't like to be at a rehearsal not knowing what's happening. So, I mean, that makes life so much easier. He remains a kind of hidden gem.
You're rambling boys of pleasure, give ear unto these lines I write.
I was enjoying, I wish I was in Belfast town to begin with, and, you know, to my ears, the vocal turns and trills you bring to your performances have always grabbed my attention, and be it here or listening to you on Thistle and Shamrock or recordings, but as you're performing this music, I'm wondering what sorts of you know, roles those ornaments play in what you're doing and what it feels like for you to sing them.
Well, that's not too easy, because a lot of singing like that is kind of arbitrary in a way, you know. I mean, you'd sing that song a few times and gradually it would sit into a way of singing it. But I think the feeling of it is the most important. I mean, that song is wonderful poetry. I wish I was in Belfast town, or it's usually called You Rambling Boys of Pleasure. It's a wonderful song. You know, it's four verses of this man thinking that he's found his true love, and gradually in the third verse he realizes that she's got somebody else. And in the fourth verse he says, I wish I was in Belfast town and with money in my pocket and a lot of drink to be had and my sweetheart beside me, but seeing as how that can't be so, I'll go out and find somebody else because I'm young and the world is wide. And I just think it's a beautiful piece of poetry, that. So when I'm singing it, I'm filled with the emotion of the beauty of the poetry.
When you're singing that, what sorts of thoughts are going through your mind, if any?
Well, we've all been there, you know. I mean, I was... I was a big, heavy romantic when I was most of my life, and I often had a broken heart, and so I really know how that guy feels, and I really love the way he says, "Oh well, you know, too bad." But you know, folk songs are full of that attitude. Like, what a shame that I should waste my love on somebody who's not returning it. And so I do understand that very well from the bottom of my soul.
But as the season changes, my darling girl has changed her mind. Gold is the root of evil, although it bears a glistening hue.
Well, a joyous character in the Come to the Bower and a great tribute. Is that your harmonica playing in that, the chromatic harp?
No, it's just a 10-hole single reed, usually made by Honer, but I have a selection of ones that I like.
Boy, you bring such a nice vocal quality to that. It's like you're singing through the thing.
Well, I love it too. I love the sound of it, and I always tried to play as close to the way Woody used to play the harmonica. So I love his harmonica playing, and it's nothing special, and mine is nothing special either. But it's I wouldn't be that great. I could maybe play one or two jigs a bit haltingly, but I wouldn't be somebody like Brendan Power, who's really brilliant harmonica player. But I have a nice tone, and I like the quality of it.
Will you come to the bower, or the free boundless ocean, where the stupendous waves roll in thunder and motion?
It's very nice to be able to play one thing on the harmonica and play something else on the stringed instrument, you know?
Yeah.
To get a kind of harmonic and counterpoint and things like that, all yourself. I mean, I always wanted to be just me, so that really fulfills my desire to be a band on my own.
it reminds me that you gave up on pursuing that in the realm of playing Bach fugues on classical guitar, I read.
Well, yes, it was more trouble than it was worth. You know, I mean, I did like it. I think the last thing I learned was a suite by Debussy. You sound like you know a bit about classical music.
Classical music, I do, and I did actually for 6 months attempt to learn classical guitar when I was in college with the hopes of wooing young women, and I got so frustrated with the buzzing of the frets, I gave it up. I was a clarinetist, but anyway, I read that you had studied with Julian Bream, and I've always loved his playing, and I just thought that was an interesting coincidence.
Yes, well, I I'm not sure. I had about two lessons from Julian Bream, quite frankly, because he was a little bit absent-minded. I think he's quite renowned as being absent-minded. and I'd arrive for a lesson, and there'd be a note on the door saying, sorry, Andy, I forgot that I had a concert in Zurich tonight.
Oh, jeez. Oh, sorry for bringing up a sore subject. And Farewell to Kelswater was a tune that I should have heard many times, I'm sure, but what a gorgeous melody and some very nice mandolin solo work toward the end of that song. Thank you for that. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm very fond of that song, too. My mother came from that part of the world, and I didn't actually learn that from her, but when I sing it, I sometimes kind of imagine her listening to it.
And soft be their pillows at night.
The last tune I wanted to ask about, the last song, the quote that still haunts me is, it's like the blood stains on the pillowcase that I wash every day, he fades away.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a powerful, personal-sounding song and delivery in so many ways. Could you tell me the story behind the tune, He Fades Away?
Yes, it was actually written by a good friend of mine called Alistair Hewlett, who I met. He lived in Australia for a lot of his life. He was a Scotsman. He moved back to Scotland and unfortunately died a couple of years ago. But the song about an asbestos mine, blue asbestos, the worst kind of asbestos in Western Australia, and the owners of it advertised in southern European newspapers for Italians, mainly Italians, I think, to come to Western Australia where the sun always shone and it was a lovely life and work in the asbestos mines. And, of course, when they got there, they were like indentured slaves in a way because it was not just lovely sunshine. It was boiling hot in the mines and a miserable, wretched life. They were mistreated. When they tried to run away, they were captured by the police and brought back. And 20 years later, the number of them who had lung diseases, asbestosis and things like that, was a large percentage of them. And with the help of other people who were sympathetic to their cause, they brought a case against the company that owned the mines. And it's still going on after many, many years. And obviously the company's attitude is, well, if we can just keep kind of filibustering this thing, these guys will be dead and that'll be the end of it. That's, in a nutshell, what I understand the story to be. And I actually went there. Whitnoom is the name of the place. And it's, they've now taken it off the map. I think the word is de-gazetted it. So it no longer exists as a place. But there are still a few people who live there. I mean, it's a really dangerous place to live because the tailings of the asbestos are still there and the asbestos is still in the air. But it's a ghost town now.
There's a man in my bed, nobody told him. The cost of bringing home his weekly pay. And when the courts decide how much they owe him, how will he spend his money as he lies in bed and coughs his life away? He fades away, not like leaves that fall in autumn, turning gold against the grey, he fades away. Like the bloodstains on the pillowcase that I wash every day, he fades away.
Andy, thank you so much for taking time out to talk with me today. I look forward to producing this. This
David,
is great.
Thank you so much. Might I just say it's a great pleasure just to talk to somebody who has researched their subject and taken a great interest in it. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Andy Irvine spoke with me by cell phone from a friend's home in Rhode Island. He's been called the finest interpreter of traditional Irish music, one of the best songwriters to come out of the revival, and he's headed to the Community Arts Cafe in downtown Winston-Salem Friday night, June 13th, beginning at 8 o'clock. Andy's new album is Perikilna, featuring the phenomenal Dutch multi-instrumentalist Rens van der Zalm. We've been sampling from it, and you'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When we come back from this little break, it'll be time to dip behind the scenes with a man who knows film like no other, University of North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Filmmaking Professor of Cinema Studies, Mr. Dale Pollack, will shine a light on merchandising movies. It's been around forever, but the Lego movie has taken things to a whole new level. Also, Bethany Chafin gets up close and personal with award-winning poet Becky Gould Gibson. She'll be heading home after this break. I'm David Ford. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Poetry and Civil War era Moravian history is on the way later this hour. But first, we're off to the movies. University of North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Filmmaking Professor of Cinema Studies, Mr. Dale Pollack takes us behind the scenes.
We all know we live in a world dominated by brands. They're all around us. We wear them. We eat them. We sleep in them. Brands are never ending, it seems. And of course, branding has been in movies for a long time. We're all familiar with product placement. in which certain items appear in TV shows and movies because their manufacturers paid to have those objects appear. And merchandising to children is nothing new. It's been going on since the advent of movies. In the 1920s, millions of Shirley Temple dolls were sold. And in the 1950s, branding and merchandising became integral to children's TV programming. And I don't think anybody's made more money at that than Sesame Street. So my purpose in discussing this subject of branding and merchandising comes in the form of the recent success, enormous success, of the Lego Movie, which made more than $400 million worldwide and is now going to see a sequel made either this year or next year. And of course, this is part of the empire of the second largest toy company in the world, Lego. They became famous not just for expensive plastic bricks, but for licensing popular culture items like Star Wars, Harry Potter, Spider-Man, and Dora the Explorer, and incorporating Lego sets from all those cultural artifacts. And I remember being a heroic parent when I would return from a business trip to Europe with the latest new Lego set that had not yet made it to the United States. I was a king, at least until the next Lego piece came along. It's not surprising that Lego the company would want a movie based on Lego the product. What better mass merchandising avenue could you choose? And their bet paid off spectacularly. What was interesting about the movie was it was self-referential. It knew it was a movie about Legos. It understood that Legos were a product. It bragged that Legos were a product. And the theme of the movie is you have to surmount your corporate masters and be really individual in who you are. And of course, Lego has the opposite goal. Their goal is to make everybody playing with Legos. It's the brand dream. And the Lego Movie helped them achieve that dream. I was actually a big fan of the movie. I thought it was creative, intelligent, and funny. And again, it was self-knowledgeable about what it was. But that doesn't make it any less of a merchandising effort. And what Lego has very successfully done has kind of fooled us into thinking because we're aware that we're watching a Lego promotion, that somehow makes it less promotional, less directed at us as consumers who will buy products with money that leads to corporate profits. And Lego isn't the only company with this goal in mind. The number one toy company in the world, Mattel, recently struck a deal with Amazon to create original content on Amazon, a new streaming series that they would do of a character named Fireman Sam, a cartoon aimed at preschoolers, in the same way they built their brand on Bob the Builder, another extremely successful Mattel character. But unlike Bob, when Sam's show is streaming on Amazon, children will be able to immediately go onto an allied website where all the merchandising from Sam will be sold. Toys, books, games, costumes, lunchboxes, t-shirts, even little firemen's hoses. So Amazon is really pushing the limit now on what used to be two completely separate areas. The idea that children had programming designed for them, and then toys might be sold based on that programming. Star Wars wouldn't be a global franchise without that practice being employed. So there isn't something inherently evil about it. But I think what we see in both the Lego Movie and now this Mattel Amazon deal is merchandising not bothering to hide itself. It's parading itself, being obvious, open about its targeting of us as consumers, as buyers, as shoppers. This is the new frontier that awaits us in corporate branding. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts, School of Filmmaking Professor of Cinema Studies, Mr. Dale Pollack. He took us behind the scenes, and next up, Associate Producer Bethany Chafin takes us home.
Award-winning poet Becky Gould Gibson is the author of Heading Home. The book was the inaugural winner of the 2013 Lena M. Shell Book Contest, a contest awarded by the North Carolina Poetry Society and funded by the Poetry Council of North Carolina. Upon winning the award, Gibson's collection was published in 2014 by Main Street Rag Publishing Company of Charlotte, North Carolina. Heading Home is organized into four sections, and Gibson's work incorporates subjects from the natural world, discusses origin and tradition, and engages readers with playful conversation between historic figures. Gibson herself holds a PhD from UNC Chapel Hill, has taught literature, writing, and women's studies, mostly at Guilford College, and her poetry has appeared in journals such as the Connecticut River Review, Feminist Studies, Brooklyn Review, the Comstock Review, and also has appeared in several anthologies. Becky will be reading from Heading Home June 13th at 7 p.m. at Glenwood Coffee and Books, and also on June 26th at the Vin Master in Charlotte. Becky stopped by WFDD to tell me more about herself and her poetry. We began by discussing some pivotal moments in her own life and in her career as a writer. Tell me about the birth of your daughter, if you don't mind.
This is boasting, I suppose, but at the time, we believed in natural childbirth, and I was determined that I would not have any medicine. I probably should have because it went on a long time, and I remember everything. And what's amazing is that 16 years later, I didn't write anything down, but 16 years later, when she left home for boarding school, suddenly I had to write this poem about her birth, and it was all there. And what astonished me about it was how indelible the impressions were and how close I had felt to the end of life and how the beginning of life and the end of life are just bound up together. I was not about to die, but I thought I could have, and that nature was betting on this new life, not on the old one. It was very strong, and I was very grateful that everything worked, but it wasn't about me. That was the amazing thing. For the first time in my life, something was not about me. And it was a force beyond my control, and that was astonishing. It was astonishing. And I think it's similar, but way more powerful than maybe the forces that come through us that we need to write. And there's some kind of energy from elsewhere, not from our personal life, but somewhere else, is similar to this feeling that I had. And whether you call it universal or you would call it the collective unconscious or whatever you call it, it's powerful and it's not really tied to a person's individual life as much as to the unity of all. So, yeah, I mean, I'll never get over that. And then when my granddaughter was going to be born, it was just a natural segue for me to involve myself by paying attention to this child in utero. But, of course, I wasn't actually giving birth, but I felt like I needed to do something. So I wrote a poem. And I think the poem was probably a charm because I was very worried. I always worry about life coming to fruition in the right way. And so this was my charm for her and for her mother.
You mentioned with the birth of your daughter, there was this event that signified life not being about you, kind of a turning point. And I found that I think a lot of your poems have a feeling of generosity. They're about other people, or they're dedicated to other people, or they evoke other people. And obviously, some of them you are speaking to, say, a writer or poet or religious figure of the past. So where in your poetry do you, your sense of yourself, where does that meet your sense of the other people that maybe you're reminded of in a work?
In the word, in the actual word. And I have to say that when I started writing poems that are addressed to people, whether they're imaginary people or historical people, or whether they're actually not people at all, but chicory flowers or goldfinch or whatever, that the poetry felt more urgent and more alive because it's like a letter to another being. And so there's a connection being made, and I think that's what poetry is about. It's about making connections. Why else would we do it? Because otherwise we'd feel very alone in a very confusing world. I'm not sure I answered your question, but I think that's one reason I write, is that in the word itself, or in the words that I'm maneuvering on the page, there is a meeting place between poet and person, or not just poet, but some other role that maybe I've devised for myself, and whoever it is. And there's a great amount of freedom here. I don't have to just be myself, and I can be all kinds of different personas, and I can address all kinds of different kinds of beings, and gives me a great sense of belonging to the world.
When you talk about connections, whether it's between yourself and your subject matter or the words on the page, I guess I'm wondering about the connections between all of the poems in this collection, because this is a full-length collection for you. And what does it mean when you publish a poem, perhaps independent of your other pieces, versus having the ability to collect them all together, order them, have sections as you do? There are four in here. How does this feel, perhaps, versus putting one piece out there alone?
Well, it's very, very different. It's as though you have one person leaving his family and going abroad and having to be himself or herself, or showing up at a family reunion and there you are among all your other family members. There are familial connections among these poems which may or may not appear to the reader at first, but I do think they are about interrelatedness between present, past, and the human and non-human worlds, and I think it is about that. But I had to think hard about what they were about, because I'd been writing these poems over at least 20 years, and the oldest are probably 20 years old, and the latest just a few months old. And what is the connection? Is this just a random collection of things? Well, it's not. And for one thing, it comes from a consciousness of a single person, yes. But I was glad to know that I really do have a kind of overall sense of why these poems belong together. This is a poem of 15 sonnets in sequence, and it's a double crown, which means these are linked sonnets. The last line of each sonnet then is repeated in the next first line of the next sonnet. So there's a linking that actually makes connections and linkages among the poems and also among the generations. Let's go to the sonnet at the point where the poem started, because I didn't start out saying, oh, I'm going to write a poem about my grandchild in utero. Instead, I was bowled over by a sonogram that my daughter sent me, and it was about the 20th week, 19th or 20th week. The sonograms are very surreal, and they're very interesting images that got my brain moving. And we also learn that for a girl, she has all of her eggs from that moment. And I thought, oh my, that astonished me. In the bright globe of your mother's belly, you have your own seeds inside you. Eggs formed by week 19, ready to outlive you. Unborn daughters wait in your unborn womb. Brain takes up half your cranium. Plato, is he right? Knowing's only remembering what you knew before you were born? If so, what do you know you may never relearn? Now we know you're a girl. We'll be woman. We'll hook a bra without looking. May not have heard what some may yet tell you, that man was made before woman, that God forgot to make her until man reminded him. So first, man's best, the crown of creation. 8. So first, man's best, the crown of creation, not so. if you consider what comes last, not as less than, but rather perfection. Let the crown fall as it may. The contest will bore you. She sends the last sonogram, your vertebrae, an ancient fossil, coiled sea creature, Ouroboros, herringbone necklace, your face a mask of polished gold for masquerade or funeral, your foot slender as the foot of a shoe model, leg and ankle, wood sign over a bootmaker's shop in a medieval village. Child, soon you'll arrive all pink and squealing, a piglet at the fair, fair and naked.
Good. And how old is your granddaughter now?
She's 4.
What's she like?
She's wild. She's crazy. She's fun. And she someday, she has her book, and the poem is dedicated to her, and someday she'll read it. Not yet.
That's wonderful. I really enjoyed that.
I can't tell you how quickly this was written, and usually my poems are arduous and take a long time, but it really comes from an encounter with a great blue heron. But what is different is that I was with my brother, and he is the one in the family who, my younger brother, who is the bird lover and the one who knows birds and identifies with birds, as I think was very clear from that day. So we were out at the wetlands on Rinalda Road, if you keep going out Rinalda, and just sat on a boardwalk and watched this great blue heron. The great blue. He calls you great blue with affection. Both of you keen-eyed fishers who stand patient for hours if need be, though he tells me he's not tied a fly in years. On a cold, cloudless day at the dead end of January, we watch from a floating boardwalk as you draw your long, narrow legs through the shallows. Head down, you step gingerly. Before the recent trouble, he made boats and fishing tackle boxes of walnut or mahogany with antique brass fittings. You use those huge wings to mount a log, maybe 6 inches higher than where you were standing, slip upon landing. Brief boarding. Why even bother for so little distance? Did you need a lift? A better view of the depths? Did it help relieve boredom? He chuckles with fraternal indulgence. He's had a rough time himself lately, the picking slender. Now he's hit bottom. Bird, why am I telling you this? What can you know of dejection? Dear heron, dear brother, birds of a feather, you're gray-blue, he's brownish, both of you balding, both of you, for the moment, beating the odds for survival, both of you with a foothold in chilly swamp waters. When you turn your head to one side, it almost disappears into light.
So you said that this poem didn't take you long to write, and I wonder, if that's the case, do you know that a poem's finished, or do you revisit it and say, I'm going to let it be for however long, and then I'm going to go back, and is there ever any editing that's done?
There's a lot of editing that's done, and my husband likes to tease me about all of my drafts, but I revise incessantly. Do you know when a poem is done? Probably not, but you do. It's an act of faith. It's a leap of faith, like anything else that's important. You just say, okay, it's done. How do you know? It pleases you. You think it's good throughout. No line jumps out and knocks you over the head and says, this is just stupid. I mean, you just sort of go with it. But sometimes poems take years. I've gone back to poems 15 years later and said, oh, now I know what to do with that. Sometimes it's a simple problem, but one that is beyond your technical powers at the time you write it. And eventually you may figure out how to solve it. It's a matter of problem solving, really, poetry. like anything else. You just keep at it until you're pleased.
I'd love to talk about something that you do throughout Heading Home, which is bring some of the figures we were mentioning, historical or religious, from the past into a more contemporary setting. And you have a lot of fun with that, from what I can tell.
I love it. I love it.
And you also said poetry is playful. And I think that really shows through in these. So if you could talk about what it was like to take those characters and bring them either to a laundromat or to a movie theater.
Well, St. Paul of the Coin Laundry is very much the saint, we know, but also put in a coin laundry. I was at Weymouth writing, and I'm writing a serious poem about St. Paul as one of the characters, but sometimes I break out and just can't be serious any longer, and it so happened that I'd forgotten to take my sheets to Weymouth, so I had to use sheets that belonged to the house, and so I had to wash them. And if I'd remembered my sheets, this poem would not have happened, I'm quite sure. But anyway, so St. Paul comes to the coin laundry. And what I like about this poem is I've created a persona for the poem, and I really like this woman so much. And then there's one on St. Augustine where I take him with me to see the Passion of the Christ and imagine what it would be like for St. Augustine to see that movie from his perspective, but also mine. And I just like it. Watch your skirt pull down the sea while I go back for candy corn and drinks. And I, for the time I'm writing the poems, I really feel like I'm in the presence of these figures. And it's not that I have control over who they were or what they wrote or what they did, but I feel like I have some kind of way of just connecting with them and making them more than just figures in a book. I mean, they're figures in my book. And they're figures in my consciousness. Once I've done this kind of work, they're with me as companions. And I can laugh at them and with them and just have fun.
Award-winning poet Becky Gould Gibson. Her latest collection is Heading Home. She'll be reading from Heading Home on June 13th at 7 p.m. at Glenwood Coffee and Books in Greensboro, and on June 26th at the Vin Master in Charlotte. Heading Home is the inaugural winner of the 2013 Lena M. Shell Book Contest, awarded for a full-length book of poetry by a North Carolina writer. The book contest was awarded by the North Carolina Poetry Society and funded by the Poetry Council of North Carolina. Heading Home was published by Main Street Rag Publishing Company of Charlotte, North Carolina. For more information and a full list of Becky's readings, visit our website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break right now. Upon our return, it'll be a fascinating look at the Piedmont Triad region during the Civil War years with three historians who really know their stuff. The new Winston-Salem Museum's got you covered next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend. The new Winston Museum, now in its second year of operation, showcases and preserves the many fascinating stories of this region from 1849 to present, with oral histories, research, education, and collaboration. The museum's lecture recital, The War at Home, included live performances of powerful wartime songs with tenor Glenn Siebert, pianist and Moravian Music Foundation director Dr. Nola Reed Knaus, and commentary by research advisor Philip Dunnigan. The exhibit, The War at Home, will remain on display through June 28th.
I was fascinated to learn about how divided the community was, about how a majority of Forsyth Countyans were against secession from the beginning. And that's not just in Salem. We might imagine that Moravians were largely pacifist and had a large connection to Pennsylvania, so there would be an understandable reticence against secession. But even in Winston and the rest of Forsyth County, there was a reluctance to abandon the Constitution. And a lot of that lasts throughout the war. We see a lot of examples of secret societies, of peace meetings, of anti-Confederate activity locally. And at the same time, you have the people on the exact opposite side. And so we see this very dualistic type of existence in Winston-Salem.
Interesting. What sentiments were playing out there, and what was part of the culture, Moravian culture at that time, that enabled that discussion, Nola?
The Moravians, like the rest of the community, were divided. They had a background of pacifism, of not participating in wars that had stood them in good stead for centuries, in fact. At the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, for instance, the Moravians presented what we believe is the first celebration of July 4th in the country's history here in Salem in 1783. But that was not a celebration of, oh, thank God we won. It was a, thank God now there's peace and we can get back to living our lives.
How about that? How was that message lost over the years?
The Moravians didn't make a whole lot of big deal out of it. I mean, we did make a big deal out of the celebration, yes, but we've not been very good at telling our own story over the years. Tooting our own horn is not something the Moravians do very well.
Well, I'm sorry to say that tradition continues to this day in the triad.
It's our job at the Moravian Music Foundation to try to toot our own horn and to bring that history out and interpret it for people to see just what a wonderful treasure the Moravians have left to us for today.
The exhibit, The War at Home, will remain on display at the new Winston Museum, 713 South Marshall Street in Winston-Salem, through June 28th. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. Our intern is Michaela Nance. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well, at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.